Welcome back, everyone. Today, we are with a replacement speaker. I think James, if I can find him in the pictures. There he is. Ah.
Hello.
Hello, James. Thank you for taking on the added responsibility today. And I'll turn it over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Good to see you virtually. Look forward to seeing you in person again someday soon. So yeah, hi. Everybody hears me all right, yes? Just making sure. Oh, good, okay, thumbs up. Virginia gives me the thumbs up, I know I'm good. so yeah, I step in at the last minute Friday morning. This all came down that Lisa, who I'm sure many people know quite well, is having some vocal cord issues or problems with her voice. And as a professional singer, she needs to take care of it and not give a Dharma talk for, 45 minutes or so, which would only exacerbate her problems. So a lot of metta to her, and I'm glad I could help her out. I actually met Lisa about 20 years ago because I'm also a musician here on the Portland scene, and she and I did a show together when I was playing trumpet in a soul and blues band, and she stepped in as our bassist and vocalist. Actually, for Hood to Coast Relay Finish Line, we played that together, and that was a wonderful afternoon. I remember her quite well from that. So I was really surprised when I joined Bright Way and saw she was a member of the Sangha. I was very, very pleasantly surprised. So I feel honored to be stepping in for, in true musician fashion, I'm subbing for her on the gig today. You can put it that way. So because it was a little bit short notice, and I'm not a professional Zen teacher with a whole pile of Dharma talks sitting around just ready to be given out, I'm going to maybe fudge just a little bit. And I'm going to do something I've heard people do from time to time, but I thought was maybe a good idea today. Dharma story time. Yeah, you go to the library and they've got the kids section, and the librarian sits there and says, okay, kids, gather around. We're going to tell a story. So I don't have pictures to show. There's no pictures, but I am going to read out an essay. It's a relatively short essay, so don't worry, like, oh my gosh, we'll get read to here. If I had to list my top, you get your top 10 favorite texts, your top 5 favorite texts. Well, in my top 3 favorite Zen texts, number one is the Sinsin Ming, the verses on Faith Mind by the third patriarch, Tsingchun. My second is the Fuken Zazengi by Dogen. And then actually by extension, some of the other fascicles in the Shobogenzo and beyond. But the one I'm going to read to you today is number 3 on my list. And is the only one by a contemporary teacher. And I've said his name many, many times. I literally just said it in the breakout room. Even like any chance I get to talk about this guy, I will talk about him. And that's Zoketsu Norman Fisher, the former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center and the current leader of the Everyday Zen Foundation. Early in my Zen experience, I picked up a book by that was edited by John Dido Laurie called The Art of Just Sitting. And I think I can do this. I tried to prep, a little prep work I could do. Let me see if I can put the link to it in the chat here, if it's still on my clipboard. It's not working the way I wanted it to. Okay, oops, I don't know what happened. Okay, well, I will figure it out. Anyway, it's called The Art of Just Sitting, edited by John Dido Laurie, who is the abbot, now deceased, of course, but was the abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery, Mount Temple, New York, and the Zen Center of New York City. Now his Dharma heir, Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi, is the leader in his stead. But Dido Laurie, if you haven't spent any time in Zen, of course, you've probably come across his teachings, quite a magnanimous teacher in his own right. But he edited this compilation of essays that were strictly on the art of Shikantaza. What's the subtitle of the book, Essential Writings on the Art of Shikantaza. And it's an interesting compilation because it includes a lot of writings from contemporary Zen teachers, but it also includes some ancient writings from China and Japan. And it even includes the full text of the Satipatthana Sutta itself, by Shakyamuni, ostensibly spoken by Shakyamuni Buddha. Norman Fisher, of course, contributed an essay, and the name of his essay is "A Coin Lost in the River is Found in the River." And I love that title so much that, like I said, I'm a musician. I'm coming out with an album in a couple of months, and I made this the title of one of my compositions. "A Coin Lost in the River is Found in the River," because it just had such a profound effect on me, and is, again, one of my top three texts. So I'd like to read it out and then make a couple of comments on parts of it that really struck me. You know how you have a favorite book or a favorite text, and you get out it has such a profound effect. You get out the highlighter and you start to, this is mostly yellow, you know, from the highlighter. Like I would have done a better job highlighting the text that didn't have a profound effect on me than the text that did, because it's heavily highlighted. I'm not going to talk about everything that I've highlighted, but there are a couple of things here that I thought were particularly salient points that I'd like to share with you today. So I'm going to buy 15 minutes of time by letting Norman Zelketsu Fisher speak through my voice, but then I'll have some things to say. And then I'm sure we'll have some time remaining at the end. I'd be interested if anybody else has read this particular essay or has anything that I say when I read it out is particularly striking to you. I would like to open it up for a little bit of discussion at the end, and we'll see what the time we're left. Okay, so yes, once again, this is an essay from a compilation edited by John Dido Laurie called "The Art of Just Sitting," and this is the essay called "A Coin Lost in the River is Found in the River" by Zelketsu Norman Fisher. Here we go. Today, I want to talk about Zazen, Zen meditation. Here is how Dogen begins his Fukan Zazengi, his fundamental text on Zazen. Quote, "The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one, right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice?" End quote. Zazen is fundamentally a useless and pointless activity. A person is devoted to Zazen, not because it helps anything or is peaceful or interesting or because Buddha tells him to do it, though we may imagine that it helps or is peaceful or interesting, but simply because one is devoted to it. You can't argue for it or justify it or make it into something good. You just do it because you do it. It's not even a question of wanting to or not wanting to. Zazen for Zazen's sake. Birds sing, fish swim, and people who are devoted to Zazen do Zazen with devotion all the time, although there is no need for it. Our life is already fine the way it is. Everything that happens is already a manifestation of our original enlightenment, even though we don't know it. We don't need to enter another condition or improve or disprove anything. The gentle rain of the Dharma is falling all the time, evenly and freely on everything. And each thing receives that rain and uses it in its own way, each in a different way. The whole world is unfolding in a beautiful and perfect interplay of forces. We may have difficulty appreciating this, but after all, we are only people, and why would we not have difficulty? Our difficulty is this: our minds can't see difference without making comparisons, without making judgments and having preferences. We want either everything to be the same as everything else, which it is, although we can't experience it that way, or if things must be different from one another, we struggle to rank them. This kind of difficulty has to do with knowing and thinking, not with our actual being. As far as our actual being is concerned, whether we have difficulty or not, we are just fine. What then could be more foolish than the idea of religious cultivation? Than the thought that we need to change our condition and become more holy, more peaceful, or more wise. In fact, such thoughts only remove us from the holiness, peacefulness, and wisdom that are the actual essence of every moment of our lives. These qualities are with us wherever we are right now. What's the use in making efforts to acquire them? Such efforts can only lead us in the wrong direction. Someone once asked Master Yunmen, What does sitting correctly and contemplating true reality really mean? Yunmen said, a coin lost in the river is found in the river. We need to appreciate the truth of these things in order to do zazen. If we don't appreciate them, our zazen will be very acquisitive. Everything else in our lives is inherently acquisitive because our strong habitual sense of self always demands that we get some good out of everything we do. We become exhausted by all this activity, but zazen is something different. If we don't appreciate its fundamental uselessness, which comes from the fundamental all rightness of our life, we will turn it into something acquisitive and busy, just like everything else we do. Another story from Master Yunmen. Once a monk asked, what is myself? Master Yunmen said, I, this old monk, enter mud and water for you. The monk said, then I should crush my bones and tear my body to pieces in gratitude. The master gave a great shout. He said, the water of the whole ocean is on your head right now. Speak, speak. The monk couldn't say anything. Master Yunmen answered for him, speaking from the monk's standpoint. I fear that you, master, don't think I'm genuine. The problem is that we actually are incapable of seeing zazen as useless because our minds can't accept the fundamental genuineness and all rightness of our lives. We are actually very resistant to this reality. We hate it because it is too simple, and we persistently think we need more. This is not a detail or a quirk of our minds, and it is not even a habit, really. It is the deep nature of our minds. The Sanskrit word for consciousness is vijnana, which means to divide or to cut. In order for us to have what we call experience, we have to divide or cut reality. Genuineness or all rightness is wholeness, indivisibility, so it can't be an experience. And even if we practice zazen and we have an enlightenment experience, we immediately confuse ourselves with it. Such an experience can be a promising beginning, but we have to be careful to let go of it, not to define it or to name it, not to make it into a cherished memory, into a hook for identity. Dogen goes on in the Fukun Zazengi. And yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. Suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things, attaining the way and clarifying the mind, raising an aspiration to assault the very sky. One is making the initial partial excursions about the frontiers, but is still somewhat deficient in the vital way of total emancipation. He then continues, you should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. End quote. This backward step is a famous saying of Master Dogen. It is the opposite of knowing and experiencing, or rather, prior to knowing or experiencing, not prior to in time, but in depth. In any case, all language fails us here because what I'm trying to express doesn't have to do with space or time, and all our language is built on metaphors of space and time. One student had a good image for it. He said consciousness is like cutting an onion. The edge of the blade of the knife comes into contact with the skin of the onion and immediately slices it, and the onion is divided. Every moment we divide the world like this and feel separate and lonely in it, divided from ourselves, divided from everything, in exile, lost. And someone else added, we cry because of this, just as we cry when we divide the onion and release its juices into the air. The backward step is that time when the edge of the blade of the knife touches the skin of the onion. At that precise instant, there isn't any division. Not even between knife and onion, let alone onion and onion. There's only one thing, contacting itself, in touch completely with itself. This is how our life is in the present moment. One thing in touch with itself, not past, not future, and not present either. This is the backward step, resting in the very beginning of the act of consciousness. When I say this, it sounds as if I mean that we should carefully analyze our minds and carefully watch every act of consciousness. Although this might be a useful exercise, and an exercise incidentally that can only be done in the midst of and after careful training in meditation, still, it is a fundamentally futile exercise because it is based on a space-time notion of consciousness. They say in Zen that a fingertip cannot touch itself and that a knife cannot cut itself. In fact, that first undivided moment of consciousness cannot be formed in isolation. It pervades the whole of consciousness. The whole act of slicing the onion, even the tears, is the beginning. In Zen practice, we do two things. We just do Zazen and pay attention to our lives. We sit with a spirit of the uselessness of sitting, entering it not as ourself, but as someone who is bigger than ourselves and includes ourselves. We try not to assume anything about anything. Just sit, as Dogen says, upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, nor leaning forward nor backward. Just be determined to be there without any idea of up or down, inside or outside, self or other, until the bell rings or you drop dead, whichever comes first. And then when you get up and resume your life, just be aware and simple. Know all the time, as you have discovered laboriously in Zazen, that what is going on in your mind is just what is going on in your mind, that thoughts and feelings are simply thoughts and feelings. What is actually also going on, events that the thoughts and feelings seem to refer to and define, are in reality unknown. Don't forget that. And when you do forget it, remind yourself many, many times. Be sure to keep your sense of humor. Don't get too tangled up in what happens, because while you are tangled up in something, don't get too tangled up in what happens, because while you are tangled up, something else is happening that you miss. So move through things as much as you can, just straight ahead, without too much deliberation. When we sit in Zazen, we take care of our posture and try to pay attention to our breathing. When we breathe in, we know this is breathing in. And when we breathe out, we know this is breathing out. We give ourselves with great devotion, creativity, and love to our breath, and we let everything else go without denying anything or burying anything. When we forget, we remind ourselves and come back. But we don't make the breath into something, and we don't make the fact of our doing Zazen into something. There are no big deals in Zen or in Zazen, because everything in our whole life and in the whole wide world is a big deal. So how could anything be special? If everything is a big deal, then there is no such thing as a big deal. What we mean by big deal is that something is important and something else is not. So we don't worry about our Zazen, and we don't think we are doing it right or doing it wrong. We just do it. My favorite Zen dialogue about Zazen, which I quote whenever I have an excuse, is the saying of Master Chao Zhou. When a student asked him, "What is Zazen?" he replied, "It is non-Zazen." The student said, "How can Zazen be non-Zazen?" Chao Zhou replied, "It's alive." In Fukan Zazengi, Dogen says, quote, "The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the manifestation of ultimate reality. Traps and snares can never reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like the dragon when he gains the water, like the tiger when she enters the mountain. For you must know that just there in Zazen, the right Dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the very first, dullness and distraction are struck aside." End quote. Ultimate reality sounds like a pretty exalted idea, but actually, where would ultimate reality be? Is it under my zafu? Is it buried deep within my brain? Is it in a cloud or under the ocean? I think it is in all those places and everywhere else as well. So sitting in Zazen or not sitting in Zazen is not preparation for something else. My Zazen, your Zazen, and Buddha's Zazen are all the same, manifestations of ultimate reality. It's not a question of meditation or non-meditation. It's a wonderful thing because it's the one thing that is incorruptible. Traps and snares can never reach it. Reality is reality, no matter what anyone does or does. Reality is reality, no matter what anyone does about it or doesn't do about it. You don't need to understand it. You can't understand it. All you need is confidence in it. Once you sit down and have real confidence in sitting down, not because it is something wonderful, but just because it is nothing and useless, supremely useless, then you have real confidence in your life. Things could certainly fall apart tomorrow. You could be disgraced and humiliated and lose your job or your reputation, your husband or wife or your body. But it would still be ultimate reality. It would still be real and genuine life, and you would be able to bear it and be with it and see deeply into it for what it is. We are living in an historical period in which we understand that it is necessary for all of us to be conscious and active in our world. None of us can ignore this call to action. And yet, if we do not practice Zazen, whether we call it Zazen or whatever we call it, and however we do it, we cannot act in any accurate way. There has been plenty of action, too much action. What we need is not more action. We need enlightened action. And this means letting go of action. As much as I'd just like to stop there, just let that be what it is. I should probably say a few words. Excuse me. So I'll say a few quick points about what I appreciate most about that essay. And then if there are any parts of that that were particularly striking to you or interesting to you that you would like to comment on or discuss, then we can certainly do so. I think the first thing that struck me about this essay when I read it, like I said, when I read this, I was relatively new to Zen. I'd practiced in the Theravada Thai Forest tradition, and then the Rinzai, I was new to Soto, and I wasn't really reading Soto-related texts. I was doing Rinzai, and I was reading a lot of koans and whatnot, but Shikantaza, I didn't know much about it. So I picked up that book, and was just I'm curious, and I came across this essay, and the first thing I said was, how audacious. How crazy. I love Norman's, I love his irreverence first and foremost, and his just kind of matter of fact, devil may care attitude, you know, like not putting things up on a pedestal, but rather putting them up there and then just dragging them right back down. You know, I think if any living Zen teacher really embodies the Zen saying of if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha, that's probably him. He does a good job of that. So the things that really struck me, first and foremost, because as I read it, I was like, what is this guy talking about? This is crazy. Was really that first actual sentence of his, because he starts off with a little introduction and then he quotes the Fukan Zazenki right out of the gate. So his first real actual sentence is, Zazen is fundamentally a useless and pointless activity. What? Here is an amazing Zen teacher, well-respected Zen priest, saying that the fundamental activity of Zen is pointless and useless. How does that make sense? And it took me a long time, and I'm not there, but it took me a long time to really get my head around what he means by that, which is it's useless and pointless because we shouldn't feel like we have to do it. But I think that that's a lot of what most of us feel and experience. Like, I have to do Zazen. I know I'm like, you know, I'll go about my daily routine and I try to fit my Zazen in a specific time of day. But if that doesn't work out, then I'm like, oh no, I haven't sat today. I need to sit today. You know, I don't want to miss a day. And so we feel like we have to do it, you know. And okay, well, why do you feel like, why couldn't you skip a day, James? Oh, well, because I need to sit Zazen. Well, why do you need to sit Zazen? Well, because it makes me feel better. Ah, okay, now we're getting to it, you know. And this is where later in the essay, Norman really gets to the heart of it and kind of calls out the inconvenient truth. And I think the uncomfortable truth that a lot of Zen students feel, which is that's acquisitive. You're trying to get something. You're trying to get somewhere. You're trying to accomplish something and achieve something with that mindset. And Norman's standpoint here is that's the wrong way to approach it. Don't do it to get somewhere. Don't do it to become something. Don't do it to get to a different state. And even says that in a later paragraph. We don't need to enter another condition or improve or disprove anything. And I guess I never really thought about improve and disprove being, you know, antonyms of each other. So I said, oh, improve. Yeah, I'm trying to improve my life as Zazen. But then disprove, like, oh, what does that mean? Oh, maybe by disprove, I thought would be the opposite of prove. So, you know, what am I trying to prove to myself? Right? Looking at it from that context. Like, oh, yes, I am a worthwhile Zen student. Look, I got my wagesa. You know, I just shave my head. I do the whole thing. It doesn't mean anything. Right? It's just decoration.
Time for a comment.
Sure, go ahead.
So far, you're doing a bang up job. Much better than the talk you gave before, where you were always washing the dishes and cleaning up the cat box.
I still have to do those things too.
I'm glad you started with Norman Fisher, because I've become a new fan of his, and I agree with you. And what I love so far about what you've said about Zazen. Being useless and all, it ties in with what I've been observing recently. I was reading the Heart Sutra again, and in the middle of it, it says, I mean, the formula is right there. There is no attainment and nothing to attain. And that's why the Bodhisattvas overcame all fear and realized perfect nirvana. So it kind of means the same as what you described about Zazen, that there shouldn't be any attainment, trying to attain anything. While I have your attention, I googled Zoketsu because I was wondering why they call Norman Fisher that. Do you know that? Is it an honorific title just for him, or what is that? What does that mean?
I'm pretty sure Zoketsu is his Dharma name.
Oh,
his given Dharma name, given to him by his teacher.
All right, now that would make sense. Thank you. Nice.
Hey, James. Since we're talking about that very sense, I mean, first of all, I am very grateful to you and in awe that you could, you know, pick up the talk with what, 36 hours notice, maybe? I think that's just wonderful. But that sentence was the one that grabbed me. And I don't remember reading the Foucault. Well, I had not read that essay for sure early in my Zen practice. But when you read it today, my head immediately said, of course. It is a goalless activity. It has no use. What was it? Useless and...
Useless and pointless.
It has no point. Yeah. It has no point. I do it because that's what I do. And I love that. I love it because I really dislike having to explain myself to people. You know what I mean? And I don't have to explain this. I just do it.
Yeah. Beyond words and letters, right?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Jennifer. I appreciate your comments. Those are very nice. Yeah, I gathered, and I may be wrong about this. That's the other thing I love about Norman Fisher's teachings. Like, here's, you know, decades of Zen practice and writings, just, I mean, just like an amazing teacher. And he'll say something and then he'll meet him and say, but that's just me. I could be wrong. What do I know? I just love it. So I try to adopt that mentality of I'm saying things, but what do I know? I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about here. So when to your point, like when I read this whole, like it's useless and pointless, that, and then the follow-up paragraph there, our life is already fine the way it is. So those two sentences to me are very closely linked. Like Zazen is pointless and useless because our life is already fine the way it is. And it, I think that everybody would agree, like we understand that intellectually. Like I say, no, I totally get it. I get it. But there's this very, very strong, powerful, conditioned part of our brain that says, no, you're doing Zen to make your life better. You're doing Zazen to become a better person and be more peaceful and not be a total jerk to your kids and all that kind of stuff. And your life is not fine already. You've got these problems and this problem, and that problem, the other thing. And, you know, so trying to balance that. And I used to think, well, balancing that means I've got to solve that problem, which is just more of the same nonsense, right? It's not about solving the problem. And I think this is what he's alluding to when he says, our life is already fine the way it is. Like, that doesn't mean that you don't have problems. It means that your problems are fine. The good things, the joys, and the successes, and the pain, and the suffering, and the failures, and everything are equally your life, are equally reality, are equally okay, because that is reality manifesting itself as it actually is in that moment of our lives, you know? And we spend so much of our existence trying to escape our existence. We spend so much of our time and energy trying to get away from the way things actually are and trying to make things into something. No, if I could just make more money, I'll be happy. If I could just find the perfect partner, I'll be happy. If I could just, you know, get my kids out of the house and keep them from becoming serial killers, I'll be a good parent. You know, like we worry about all these crazy, and they are, of course, those are things that we should put emphasis on, but it's not everything, right? And so when he says that our life is already fine the way it is, I'm just like, oh, so Zazen isn't about getting somewhere else. It's about actually being in my life the way that it already is. Like the one time out of the day, the 30 to 60 minutes, however long I get to sit, the one time out of the day where I'm actually really, truly living my life. And the other 23 hours of the day, I'm pretending. I'm acting, I'm playing a role, you know? And I confuse that role with reality or with real life, you know, fundamental. And when I say real life, of course, I mean an absolute truth level, you know. I'm just playing a role. Oh, I'm a father right now. You know, I'm playing the role of father. I'm playing with my kids. Oh, I'm playing the role of husband. I'm talking to my wife, or I'm playing the role of employee. I'm at work and I'm doing my job. And to the degree that we confuse that with all there is to reality is amazing. Like, you know, a good metaphor that I thought of recently was, you know, I'm a big fan of Broadway shows, right? And the movie version of Guys and Dolls, Frank Lesser's Guys and Dolls, with Frank Sinatra and Marlon Brando playing the title characters. I thought, what if Marlon Brando, or, you know, Frank Sinatra, either one of those guys, what if Frank Sinatra thought he really was Nathan Detroit? What if Marlon Brando thought he really was Sky Masterson? You know, and Marlon said, oh, I live in New York City and I'm a professional gambler and I've got a crush on the Salvation Army lady, you know, like that whole thing. And he thought that was his real life, not that he was actually an actor that had played other roles in other, you know, movies and show, and he lived somewhere that was totally unrelated to Sky Masterson. It's like, what if he confused that with his real life? That would be ridiculous, right? Well, we do the same thing. We do the same thing every single day. I'm playing roles. And it's not that I'm playing the roles. It's that I'm playing the roles and I'm confusing them with all there is to reality, rather than seeing it, oh, this is just one aspect of my reality. And there's this other side to it. And that's where the Zazen, and I think this is what Norman Fisher is saying, the Zazen is what gets us, you know, helps us realize it, helps us actually live that and experience that in the moment. And thank you for the, I don't do this Zoom thing very well, so. There's a hand up apparently. I don't know who that is. I can't read this thing very well, so maybe some can help. Shiketsu is waving. Hi, Shiketsu.
So, what you just described.
It's my hand that's up.
Sorry.
Oh, John, you want to go? Yeah. It's my hand that's up.
Oh, okay.
You can't see that?
No,
okay. Anyway. I'll be brief. I haven't meditated much at all in these past, actually, I don't meditate much.
but I have for, you know, 10 plus years. And I always meditate with the group. Even so, I feel that it's really helped me deal with some really upsetting things. Some exciting, we just had a lot of excitement around my house because our dog was sick and we thought we were going to lose him. And then he started getting better. And then we got a kitten. We've been looking for a kitten, and all of a sudden one became available. So we took it. Now we have him in one of our bathrooms, and we're feeding him formula and, you know, doing all this stuff. And I'm just doing it. I'm just going ahead and doing it. I'm not anxious about it. My husband's anxious about it. Oh, all this is going on, but I'm able to just go ahead and do it. And I think that I attribute that to Zazen. You know, usually our life is pretty we're a retired couple and we don't do a whole lot, and so it's pretty quiet. So I attribute the Zazen that I do to helping me deal with real life here. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Shikatsu. Yeah, I love that. I think the funny kind of the fundamental point of what he's saying here, and what literally every Zen teaching ever in the history of Zen has ever said is, you know, we don't suffer because things go wrong. We suffer because we want them to be different. And he even alludes to in the essays, like, just go straight on. And prior to coming to Brightway, when I was at No Rank Zendo under Rinzan Pachovnik Osho, that's one of his catchphrases is, just move straight forward. Just keep going straight on, straight on, straight on. And I just love that idea of, you just do it, you know? And I find myself like having to mentally, you know, consciously think of like, just go straight forward. Even though, you know, Joan said, yeah, Joan, and that it includes the dishes and the cat box. Just go straight on, scoop, you know, and just, you know, and I would suffer. It was like, oh, I hate this. It stinks and it's terrible. These cats are dirty animals and blah, 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 you know. So I really appreciate what you said. Thank you for that. Yeah, just going, well, again, straight forward. And that's where the suffering will dissipate. So. John, did you want to ask something? And I see Alice's hand is up. Now I can see it for some reason. That's strange. Go ahead, John.
Oh, well, I was just going to ask, in relation to what you said about practice kind of helping us take our roles and ideas less seriously, that resonated with me because I feel like that's happened in my life. And the similar things to what Shoketsu was saying about practice helping in life in that way too. So then for me, the natural question is like, doesn't that suggest that Zazen is useful? Or is there a difference between, you know, the good effects that practice ends up having on our life? And is that something else than Zazen being useful or something different than us trying to make a use out of it or trying to make ourselves better? So it just seems like,
I think there. That, and that's, yeah, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I think that's kind of the point. Like when we hit that, I think as, and again, this is just me. This has been my experience that I go forward and I read something or I hear something and I'm studying and I'm sitting and I'm doing my Zen practice. And I'm like, oh yeah, this makes sense. And like, it's intellectual, right? Because we're always up here. We're so much up here in this thing, right? And there's a little, it's harder to pull this down here to the heart, to the hara, to really embody, you know, what these things that make sense mentally or intellectually. And so it'll make sense. And then we hit a paradox or a seeming paradox, right? We hear, wait a minute, but doesn't that mean, like, to your point, like that's, but it seems like Zazen actually is useful. So how can you say it's not, you know? I think that's actually that is the core of the practice right there. That paradox, that balance between what we think is and what might, you know, what else it might be, to not try to solve that, to not try to make Zazen useful or useless, to kind of let it be both, and to just balance and sit in that center, sit in that place of balance without trying to make it something that it's not. So I, you know, when he says this, I think there's a point to which he's kind of trying to be a little bit provocative, you know, because we can make a case, even though he says you don't have to make a case for it or justify it. I think we can make a case for it and justify it by saying exactly what you said. Well, yeah, I have seen firsthand, and I'm sure you have too, sitting zazen, the result, it's all causes and conditions, right? It's all karmic, right? So if I sit more, the end result of that is that I'm more equanimous and more peaceful or whatever, right? So it seems like it is useful. But I think the point here is that, well, that's kind of where you already are or should be, right? That's your real life. You know, those end results that you're seeing are actually what your real life is. We just pretend that it's something else. So that's this life of, you know, disappointment and sorrow and getting what we don't want. And sometimes we get what we do want and all that type of thing. So yeah. It's hard to wrap our heads around. And I don't think we're meant to really wrap our heads around it. We're meant to wrap our hearts around it. That's probably not that's a non-answer there. Alice. Hi.
Hi. So your essay really touched me because being a mom, I sometimes think about what my daughter is going to go through in life, you know, disappointment, successes, achievements, all that. But the number one thing that comes to my mind that's like the most, not challenging, but like fruitful to watch in a sadistic kind of way, but also in like a developmental kind of way, is like, she's 10 years old right now. And I'm sure a lot of you can probably relate to this, but one day she's gonna fall in love. And one day that person's gonna break her heart. And you can say that it's her fault or his fault or her fault or whatnot, whatever's fault, it just will happen. And I don't know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of you can probably relate to this, but the first time you get your heart broken, it is downright the closest to death you can feel. Can't eat, can't sleep. You are just literally a waste of a human being when you've just broken up with someone who you fell in love with. And as a parent, now, when I was going through this in my younger years, I didn't have a parent to talk to, but then I know that it will happen to my daughter and I'm going to have to watch it happen. And there is really nothing to say to someone who is having their heart broken. It just is what it is. It just happens. And with that, I also know as a mother, some wisdom about that feeling of being utterly broken, however long it will take, months, years, days, weeks, hopefully months, but it will pass. But it's also such a horrible feeling at that time, but it's also such a good feeling for you to grow out of or to experience, right? Because I don't know, like it's kind of like there's some sweetness to it. You almost have to feel that way because then you can cherish whatever that comes forward, or I don't know, it's part of being human, I guess. So that wisdom, I feel, is kind of the wisdom that I want, not to capture, but to like remind myself of whenever I sit zazen or whenever I'm going through a hard time. You know, it's a wisdom that I can never attain, but it's a wisdom that I already, I guess, have. Or will have, that this is just life unfolding and there's nothing to say about it.
Thank you. Sorry, go ahead. Continue. Sorry to interrupt you there. Did you have something you'd like to add to that? No? Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. I was just talking about this in my day job. You know, it's funny how there's a lot of overlap. And I made reference to the fact that you look at your life, you think about all the good things that have happened in your life, what the things that you like right now, you know, and I look at the things, like, for instance, I look at my, my job. I'm happy in my job. I've been doing it a long time. It's afforded me a comfortable lifestyle. I love my wife. I love my kids. And I look at those great things, those things that I would be sad to lose. And I realize that they came from pain and suffering. They originated in pain and suffering because the relationship I had prior to my wife, if it had worked out, I wouldn't be with my wife. You know, so I'm glad that that person broke my heart and that I was a miserable wreck for, you know, some length of time and all that, because it put me in a position to meet my wife and to be in a mental and emotional state to where I was ready for the relationship that we developed and the kids that came out of it after I'd sworn off I was never going to have kids, you know, that, like, so that, that type of thing. If you pull the good things in your life back far enough to their origins, you can see they always originated in something that you did not want to happen, right? And so I hope that she can see some of that, to your point, like when she gets her heart broken, but eventually she's, oh, this is actually opening up a door to something better, you know. There was a, when I was studying in the Thai forest tradition, the tradition of Ajahn Chah, who was a very famous Thai master. And there was a very famous story of his disciple, Ajahn Sumedho, who's currently the kind of de facto leader of the entire tradition right now. And he had assigned Ajahn Sumedho to found a monastery in England. And so he did so. He goes to England and he founds this monastery and he's, you know, got everything built up. But a couple of years have gone by. And he goes back to Thailand and meets with Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah says, how's the new monastery going? And Ajahn Sumedho said, oh, it's great. The people are wonderful. Like, everything is just fine. And he lists off this laundry list of wonderful things. And Ajahn Chah goes, you're never going to learn anything that way. You know, and I just, that's such a, I love that. Like, anytime I encounter those kind of difficulties too, like, I'm never going to learn anything anyway, any other way. So this is good. You know, this, bring it on, pain and suffering. Let's learn something today. You know, I wish I had that kind of chutzpah about it, but I don't really know. Maybe I'll strive for that. So, yeah, thank you. That's great. I really appreciate your comments today. Thank you so much. Anybody else want to share or add? I'm done talking.
Hey, Soan picked a really great sub. You did great. Thank you so much, James.
Oh, she didn't pick me. I volunteered. I was the first and only one that volunteered, I think. And then Domio sanctioned it. So I said, all right, well, I guess I'm on.
Glad you were on today.
She's at the beach enjoying herself right now. She doesn't know anything. This is going on. So, good for her. I'm glad she's on a break. Thank you, Joan. I appreciate that. Anyone else have any comments about the essay?
Is there any way to, like, send it forward for us to reread? And
yeah, my copy of the book is actually a Kindle edition. I had to, like, take screenshots from the cloud reader and print it out to get anything, because I'm on the same device that my Kindle reader is on right now, so I couldn't, you know, do the digital thing. I think the book might be available in PDF form. I haven't actually, I just purchased it through Amazon, the Kindle version. I don't know. If you just, if you Google Dido Lori, D-A-I-D-O, and then Lori is L-O, that much I can put in the chat. I had it. I, like, was so prepared. I, like, went to Google and I had the link, the hyperlink to the Wisdom Publications. Sorry, you got to look at my fingers for a second while I type. So there's Dido. Oh, not Daisy. Thanks a lot, Siri. Sheesh. Dido. There we go. Okay. And then it's the Dido Lori, and it's The Art of Just Sitting. It's got a really cool, like, floating rock on the cover. And I would strongly recommend getting that book in whatever way you can, because there's a lot of really amazing essays in there. And prior to coming to Zen, when I was doing Theravada, the Satipatthana Sutta was actually my main practice, just sitting and going through the four foundations of mindfulness. And so when I saw the Satipatthana Sutta in there, I was like, oh, yes, good. There's some overlap, but I already know. I mean, it's all connected. I was being kind of dumb about it at that point in time. But yeah, there's a wealth of really, really amazing essays in there from a whole host of really excellent writers. So I highly recommend. And I'm not getting any royalties off the recommendation of the book. James. Hopefully I didn't violate some copyright law by reading it out. I don't know. Maybe I did. Yes, Mary.
Yes, thank you. Great talk. Great essay. I really enjoyed that. There's a lot in there. The one thing that sort of stood out for me was the mentioning of the step back several times. And that seemed, you know, it's again, one of those things where it's two-sided, where it's kind of one side is kind of like a self-retreat or a moment, you know, just of reflection about where you might be. And the other is just silence, just to be there and not do anything or think anything or, you know, any of that. But it's an action that requires nothing. So it brought up a lot for me, just, you know, hearing a little bit about that. But again, thank you for your talk. It was great.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the Fugun. Like I said, Fugun Zengi is my second up one. And that backward step is just so profound, you know. And it's a good, I've used that in my Zazen too, just like that visualization of taking a stepping backward out of my relative existence, out of what I believe is true and not true, and just, you know, and he echoes that in the essay where he says, you know, that backward step is resting in that moment before consciousness. Like, you're here, but you haven't started telling a story about being here, right? Like, I'm sitting in my room, and okay, I'm sitting, I'm in my room in my house, it's a little warm in here, you know. I've got to go and make lunch soon. And, you know, like, and then we start proliferating. But like that moment where I just am present is an example of that backward step, that just resting in that moment prior to consciousness. So yeah. Thank you, Mary. Yeah.
Anyone else? I just looked up that book, and, you know, on Amazon, you can peek inside. And there is an essay, it looks like, by G.U. Kennett, who is Domyo's teacher's teacher.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't read that one in a long time. I should go back and check that one out. Thank you for the reminder that that's in there. Yeah, I think I gravitated towards that book because I had heard already of Shikantaza, and you know, I've been studying with Rinzan, and he said, well, you know, we do the koan contemplation, you know, you work through your koan, you just kind of let your koan rest while you're in Zazen. He said, but I actually practice Shikantaza mostly. I was like, Shikantaza, what is he talking about? So I went through that book, and like, I didn't even understand. I still don't, and I'm not meant to, I guess, but... So yeah, now I'm gonna have to go back and reread the whole thing.
I think it's okay to end early.
Sure. Yeah, I teach. It was part of my job. I'm a trainer. And then we just had to do remote training, remote learning since the beginning of COVID. And I was ask a question or make a statement and then sit in silence. And one of my students finally said, you really like uncomfortable silences. I was like, wow. So kind of to John's earlier point, like that's actually a result of my Zazen. That's an outcome. Like, perfectly fine just sitting here saying nothing and just looking at the screen. But yeah, just unless anybody has something to add, I wanted to leave enough space for that. I agree with Jinryu and you can call it a day. Well, Bob, I guess I'll kick back to you. Is that it? You can just leave, or do you have something? Is there some official anything that needs to be said?
Thanks, James. Surely appreciate this was an amazing talk. It's a discussion, but it's very good. Thank you very much for stepping up to the plate and taking on this difficult task on such short notice. You're right. Most priests and ministers and teachers have a backlog of sermons or talks they can just pull out of the file cabinet and go, okay, let's see, let's start here. And excellent, just amazing. So actually, I don't recall the words that they use at the end, but I think Jinryu does.
I can do it, Bob, if you want me to.
Please do. Thank you much.
We offer the merit of James's wonderful talk and our discussion to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thanks,
everyone. Nice
to see you. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks again, James.
Thank you. That was great. Bye-bye. Good job. Great. Impressive. Truly impressive.
Thank you, sir. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Bye.
Wednesday.